1101. This is WEAA and a special live presentation of the Freddie Gray funeral. I'm Beverly Burke, just outside New Shiloh Baptist Church. Outside under cloudy skies, we have kept the temperatures cool but have held back on the rain as crowds are right now continuing to enter New Shiloh Baptist Church. As you might hear in the background, there is some African drumming that's going on. That's from two men who are in the garden bench area just around the driveway where the limo for the family and the hearse are standing by. As I said, people are still drifting into the church as some are leaving after attending the public viewing earlier today. The funeral is getting started in just a few moments. The crowds that were expected have arrived. And some of those that are leaving with some emotion. Those who would allow me to talk to them told me that they were disturbed about what's happening in their community. One woman who just returned here after 3 years being back here, after 26 years of being away, she's 86, and she says she's come back and she's attending this funeral with a purpose in mind to reach out and to find a way to heal her community. There was another man who came through here, an elderly man. He was shaking his head and just said, "This is not the way our community is supposed to be." We are going to be bringing you the commentary inside and outside of the program going on today. You're inside the Mark Steiner Show. And Mark, as I bring you into this, let me just tell you that after the arrivals of Jesse Jackson and several other dignitaries, as I saw come in through this particular entrance, including NAACP City President Tessa Hill Aston, everyone really carries a very somber look. This morning's news, as you probably will recall, pointed to the recent comments that were made by Justice Department people and also Congressman Elijah Cummings about the coming investigation. Everyone wanting this to be a day of peace until a report is released, and that's supposed to happen later this week. Again, we are bringing you this live, very special presentation here on WEAA 88.9 FM. Mark?
So I'm curious, Beverly, while you're there, the people who are at the church, I mean, is there an overflow of people outside the church as well?
There is. It's not a... Security is not allowing anyone to stand outside the entrance here, but I am still seeing a steady flow of people as they are going into the church. And they are moving in family groups. And in one instance, there was a youthful group of maybe about 20 young men, and they looked like they were connected by just their association. And and they, for the most part, did not really allow themselves to speak to reporters as they were filing into the church. They had very serious expressions on their face. Now, a short time ago, and I'm glad it moved on, there was a group of motorcycle riders who came through, about 15 of them, and you wouldn't have been able to hear me then, but they made a pause right in front of the driveway of the entrance, where, again, the hearse and the limo for the family are. They paused for a moment and then moved on, moving through. So that's pretty much the scene right now. I'm not seeing much in the way of folks moving in again right now. As I said, I'm outside, and it looks like maybe if there is an overflow crowd, it's not coming outdoors. But again, I think security for this area is not going to allow anyone to hang around the sidewalks here except for reporters like myself. And I'm surrounded by live trucks and reporters standing all along this perimeter.
Well, Beverly Burke, thank you so much. And I know you'll be reporting here for the next hour at least. And we'll be talking to you and Sean Yost and perhaps Faraja Muhammad here for WEAA, live coverage of Freddie Gray's funeral. Beverly, thanks so much. We'll get right back to you.
Okay. I'll be standing by.
Thank you. And we're here in the studio here at WEAA. I'm here with the guests we had during the first hour. They stayed with us to hear commentary and talk about what they're thinking as the funeral is going on. And our callers have held on, so we're going to go to the phones here. Dave Von Love's in the studio, Director of Research and Public Policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Dominique Stevenson, Program Director for American Friends Service Committee and co-author of Martial Law, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther with Eddie Conway. Dee Watkins, author, filmmaker, professor at Coppin State, writes for Salon.com. Michaela Gilliam Price is senior, right?
Junior.
Almost had you graduating. Junior at Baltimore City College, and one of the founders of City Block, and who did a very brave thing and crossed the line in some of the earlier protests as she was trying to make contact with a black policewoman and was not arrested but was
detained.
And then Dominique Stevenson, who's in the studio, was detained with her because she said, if a young woman like that's going to do it, I'm standing up for my young sister, and went and did the same thing. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Let's go to a couple of callers, or our guests can comment here before we go back to the funeral. Afrikan, you're on the air. You've been holding on a while. Welcome.
Let everyone know how the police were formed. During slavery days, they would send slave catchers after the slaves, which we know now as the police, bring them back and do what they do today, police brutality. So that's who the police are, modern slave catchers. Where did I get this information? From Minister Louis Farrakhan. Now, the hood got to straighten their act up, too. They doing wrong, but y'all not looking at the bigger picture. They been trying to get us to focus on this while Obama and them is bombing countries. Now, what about that? Why ain't we talking about that, killing innocent people? But God has the last say. That's what I have to say this morning.
Afrikan, thank you for joining us. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Beverly on line 5.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Good morning, Beverly.
I'm going to go out to the family of Freddie, because Freddie's dead today, and he's dead at the hands of the police. For our leaders, the mayor, our city councilmen, our neighborhood association, it is beyond disappointment. It's a disgrace. As a culture and community of people, we need to hold them accountable. But yes, we do need to get our act together, and we will. We need solutions. We talk about civil rights. No one is civil these days. Women rights. They don't necessarily address the rights of African-American women, or this mother, Freddie's mother, would not be mourning her son who died at the hands of the police. As the brother said, modern day lynching. We need to address these issues. We need solutions. We need to address this in terms of our cultural differences, because we are different. God didn't make us all the same. For there's a warfare going on, and it's beyond just what we see. Yes, we must address it economically. We must address the prison issue, because that's where the majority of our brothers are, the seed, those that must carry this thing on for us as a culture of people. We must look at it medically. We must also look at it spiritually, because we're not going to die. We've come too far. We know where all the holes are and the ditches are, and we're about to turn them over. Get ready, because we're coming. It's not a threat. It's our promise.
Thank you, Beverly.
Thank you.
Dee?
Just to piggyback on that, to Baltimore, the world is watching. This is an example that people want to see. We have a black mayor. We have a black commissioner. We have a disgusting injustice that just happened. So what's the outcome? What's going to happen?
I think reflected in her statement where was a lot of issues that I see every day at school. It's that we have a need for, like, legitimately effective solutions, right? We like to hide under the guard of, oh, I'm a feminist, or, oh, I'm a civil rights activist, but what does that really mean for those who struggle with the intersections of oppression that they deal with every day, mm-hmm. right? What does it mean for me as a black girl who's 17 years old, right, who's also disabled, right? Why don't any of these things effectively solve for every part of me, right? And so that's what I think we need to be looking at, is where do we find these solutions that are going to effectively work for those who are at the most oppressed situations in society, right? We can't just start at the top. We can't just say, oh, I'm going to solve for a black man, because then where do I fit in as a black woman, right? I see a lot of very serious issues reflected in what she says, and that's what I grapple with daily. Like, what do we really do at this point? And that's why it's so overwhelming, because there's so many different social locations that we have to solve for, and where do we start?
Dominique, let me just ask you to chime in here, too. I was thinking about this in terms of you and conversations I've had with Eddie and others. And Eddie and I, who go back a long time to the late 60s, early 70s in our organizing work, and it does, some of the stuff does take, I mean, change, it's incredibly important this march took place, and more marches take place, and that it doesn't die down, and that's, I think, very important. But the question of organizing for serious change in society, I think, is what people need to start wrestling with.
Yeah, no, definitely. But I think that one of the key, to me, one of the key elements of organizing is listening to people.
Yes. Yes.
And engaging the community and finding out what folks really need and what they really want. And very often, some of the bigger stuff that we think that we need or want to tackle are not where folks on the community level are at that point, because they may be struggling day to day to put food on the table. So it's like, how do we engage community in a way where we help to resource those communities? You know, how do we create situations where, because if a community, one, is engaged and active, and there is also outside engagement of these communities like Sandtown, particularly like Gilmore Homes, one, the police can't get away with the things that they have been getting away with. They, like I said, part of it is isolation. Part of it is the fact that this is a segment of society folks don't pay any attention to until this kind of a situation occurs. We need to really decrease dependence on policing. You've had a situation here in Baltimore some years ago where a woman called the police because she had an argument with her 15-year-old. What happened? The officer came in there and he killed her son in the house. Okay? We need to create situations where there are folks in communities that people can rely on when you have a domestic dispute or a problem in the household.
Right.
That's about building community, and that takes organizing. And it's going to take a while, but What better time than now? What have we been waiting for?
Dominic, I'm not a religious human being, but I have to say to that, amen, because because I think that you, one of the things we have to talk about, the serious part of the conversation, is alternatives to policing. There are other ways to take care of things in our community. Other than, the police should be there for situations that get out of control, that you need them to come in to stop violence, to stop burglaries, rapes, all the rest. But other things in our community can be solved in different ways. They don't take police and a criminal justice system to solve everything that we face.
Go ahead.
All of that on top of the fact that since 2012, we've paid close to $6 million in settlements. So not only, and a lot of these officers still have their jobs, so not only are we paying their salaries, not only are we paying them to kill us, but we also pay for their lawsuits. So that $6 million is coming out of taxpayer money.
And I think the other piece, I mean, going back to, you know, what I was saying earlier, I think a part of the problem is many people are socialized to not be able to imagine a world without police.
Yeah,
and I think it might be time to start broaching that conversation as to what it actually looks like. Mm-hmm. And I think if we can grapple with the lunacy of the way that the police force operates in our community now, I think it presents a situation where the only meaningful way forward is a conversation about how do you reconstruct the institution of law enforcement in a way that the community owns it. And I think that's a serious conversation that we need to have.
I want to go back to the phones here, but let me play a clip. This is another interview took place in the march that was done by our producers, and we're going to hear from Dr. Lawrence Brown, who's a professor at Morgan State University, who was there that day.
Well, I think O'Malley was in many ways the architect for the type of policing that we've seen here in Baltimore. Like I said, zero tolerance, a high rate of stop and frisk. You know, so it really sort of created an environment where you had 127 murders or police killings between 1992 and 2012. A lot of that is in the period in which he's in office. And so or even in the period when he's, in which he's governor as well. And so a lot of this is taking place under his watch. And so I think the former governor, future presidential candidate, has a large responsibility to bear in terms of explaining the type of police state that we have here in Baltimore.
What do you think is at the root of the way that the police and the community are relating in places like Sandtown, Winchester?
The type of segregation, redlining, racial zoning, America's history. You know, you look at this public housing development here, Gilmore Homes. You know, public housing in Baltimore was originally segregated. You had black public housing, white public housing, and the disinvestment by the city government, by the housing authority in a community like this. You have the ABLE Foundation saying that 71% of Baltimore police don't live in the city. Over 9% don't live in the state. So when they're coming into a community like this and they're looking at it, they think just because the conditions of the community are bad, that the people here don't deserve respect. People aren't looking at how society here has forgotten about this community. You know, basically treated this community like it doesn't exist. And so, but the police, when they're here, they know that America's hardly going to be looking, and they can get a lot away with a lot of stuff. But that's changing right now.
All right. Well, this is Mark Stein. Can we have is somebody at the funeral with us? Is that what we're doing? Okay. Well, that was, countdown threw me off. Sorry. So that was Dr. Lawrence Brown. And let me get a phone call in here and then come right back to our panel, 410-319-8888. Morning, you've been holding on a long time. Welcome back. Morning, you there? Line one? Okay, then let us go to line three, Everett in Pikesville. Hi, Everett, you there?
Hello?
Everett, hi, welcome.
Hi. Thank you for letting me voice my opinion on your show. I'm listening and I'm very interested in what's being said, but we must remember history and how this country was founded, and it was started by making a place called the White House. And the White House made something called smaller chasms called the Big House, which were on plantations. And the Big House, believe it or not, if you watch the movie Django, you'll see that there were more slaves in the actual Big House than there were actual slave masters. And it was actually run by the black people in the Big House. What I'm trying to say is that when you look at our government today, we've got a lot of house Negroes who are doing the job and the work of the slave masters, and they don't even realize what they're doing themselves because they just want to be a part of a bigger game and make their money, so to speak. And that leaves the trickle-down effect towards the black people in the smaller areas where we tend to be the outside Negroes, the working class Negroes, the Negroes that don't matter, seemingly. Then you've got the overseers, which are the police who keep us in line. And a lot of times, the Willie Lynch law and Jim Crow syndrome seems to be going on with them, and they're inoculated and emancipated into these groups or gangs called the police or the factions that oversee us and keep us in place, so to speak. And their mentality is taught to them that we are the bad guys. And unfortunately, I hate to say this, but Brother Gray is the beginning of a big syndrome. I'd like to piggyback on what I heard Dick Gregory say. When you've got a man walking around with a lead vest on and lead bullets, and they tell you that lead can be detrimental to your health, what do you think is going to happen to this mentality of this man who's been inoculated with these thoughts that we are all bad guys? So it's a health thing. It's a mental battle. And it's just going to get worse until we educate ourselves. Education, or lack thereof.
Well, I'm sorry, we have to go break here because we have to go live to the funeral at this moment. Then we'll come right back to our guests. And we're here with Sean Yost, who's at the funeral. Sean, welcome. Sean, you there?
Hey, Mark, how you doing?
Good, Sean. You're inside.
Yeah, I'm right here. You hear me?
Yes, I can. We got you.
Okay. They are actually closing the casket right now during the wake. The funeral service is about to begin. Several dignitaries, including Jamal Bryant, Reverend Jesse Jackson, Reverend Jesse Jackson and Billy Murphy are entering into the sanctuary now as the funeral services are about to begin for Freddie Gray. The wake is just concluded.
And what can you tell us about the feeling in that room at the moment and who you might have been talking to?
I mean, as you could, as you could surmise, a lot of heavy hearts, a lot of heavy emotions, a lot of sadness. Freddie Gray's family has been obviously devastated by the loss of their loved one.
Yeah.
And that emotion has poured out during this wake.
Have you had a chance to talk to any members of the family while you've been there today?
I was talking to actually the daughter of Eric Garner. There's a contingent from New York here in support of Freddie Gray's family and other victims of police violence. Several of them are from New York, different family members who have suffered the same circumstances that Freddie Gray's family has suffered. And they are here in solidarity and determined to see changes made to law enforcement policies as they are practiced in this country, specifically as they affect communities of color.
It's important, I think, for us to know that that solidarity coming down from around the country with Garner's family being here is very critically important. I know that Tyrone West's family is also at the funeral, and that kind of merging, I think, is important for what comes next. Sean, thank you very much.
We'll pick up everything you said, Mark, because it's okay.
That's all right. It's okay. So we'll come back to you in a few minutes, Sean, and look forward to hearing more.
So,
thank you. Coming back here to our panel, so the service is about to begin, and we may be hearing some of the people speaking at the service in a few minutes as well. Any thoughts here as you've been listening to this and the last few callers we've had?
Just in response to the last caller,
Kayla.
It's something really interesting, this like whole house Negro versus the working Negro like dichotomy that people try to make. And it, I just feel like it's a very thin line, right? Because like, would you call that black sister in the police uniform that I was talking to at the protest a house Negro because she's working for the system, right? But she's also just trying to survive as a black woman. Right. So like, I don't know where to draw that line. And that's always been like a struggle for me. And like when I was talking to her, I was like, on one hand, you have this white police officer controlling you, you have this white system controlling you, but I respect your struggle. Right. And at what point do we start respecting the struggle of our people to the point where we understand that black survival, right, sometimes just has to be the first priority. Right. And if that means that you have to be a black woman in a uniform standing in front of black protesters and your black younger counterpart saying that you should not be crossing this barricade, like, I feel like you have to respect that. But we can also look at these instances where black people have to choose survival in a way that means they are oftentimes put against their people. Like, that is an instance of white supremacy, right? That is an instance of this, like, entrenched internal hatred that, like, we cannot get away from. And that's, like, why we have to look at the system, because we are put in so many different situations where we're either being shot down on the street or being shot by our own, right? And it's just all of these systematic instances where I just don't know where to draw the line, right? So I don't know. Maybe you guys can answer that question.
No, I think that's it. I think that what you're touching here is something important, mm-hmm. because, and I don't think this is exactly what you were alluding to, Dominique, when we were in the green room, but people, there's a lot of rhetoric in the world. Mm-hmm. But the reality of existence is much deeper. The contradictions of existence, the complexities of lives is much deeper than just simple rhetoric, I think.
Yeah, people can come into Sandtown, Winchester, and they can talk and they can rail on, you know, about the police. But the reality is when this blows over, and it will, because they always do, you know, those folks still have to live there. Those folks in the community are still going to be there. And those folks are possibly going to be the folks who are the recipients of retaliation, you know, based on the things that were said. And so I think we need to be mindful. But also, I think that that whole house Negro, field Negro thing is one, it's too, people take it too literally. And I think that goes back to Malcolm X, who was somebody I loved, and his book, was a turning point for me in my life in terms of political consciousness. But I think that we have to look at that a little bit deeper, because even when you understand the history of slavery, sometimes folks up in the house were smuggling food and things out to the field. Okay, mm-hmm. We need to understand stuff in a more unified context instead of being so black and white with it that we are sometimes damaging potential, you know, opportunities to create allies and to create relationships. I just think that that's too black and white around this situation.
It's just like that Malcolm X quote. It's like, I think it's eat out of the white man's hand until you can spit on it, right? It's just like, where do we draw the line? Like, mm-hmm. like what you said.
There's also more historical references that can be used. The Willie Lynch document was actually made up.
It wasn't
a true meeting. It didn't go down. So I guess Stephen the Root of that comment had some fallacies in it. So we got to, you got to know your stuff. It is difficult to draw the line. And, you know, if you are a black person who's working with the police department and you remain silent, then you're a part of the problem. Mm-hmm. I think I don't think being vocal or addressing some of the wrongdoing would be the cause of you losing your job and not being able to support your family. We're responsible for calling people out. I think anybody who's silent on this situation is a part of the problem. I don't care what you do for a living.
Yeah, I think one thing that's really important to keep in mind, the Fraternal Order of Police is a very powerful institution.
Yes, it is.
And I think one of the things that we need to do as a community, and I think some of us are doing, but I think could be helpful if it's ramped up, is we need to have some kind of protection for folks who do speak out. Because if you think about Crystal, was it Officer Crystal that came out and talked about, he was whistleblower on Baltimore City Police.
And had a dead rat in his car.
So what would they do to us? Mm-hmm. Is my question. What would they do to a black woman who was working for law enforcement? So a part of, I think, what we need to be thinking about is having the conversation where we can provide protection, you know what I mean, for those people that are going to speak up. Because, it's almost unfathomable the amount of power this institution has. If you think about the fact that they're the police, so they're sanctioned by the state to exact violence whenever they feel necessary and have enough financial resources to influence lawmakers to support them or at least look the other way. You know, even if we look at the Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights, I mean, it's an entire list of protections that allows law enforcement the insularity to keep information from folks that can hold them accountable. So when the mayor said on CNN on Anderson Cooper shit that she wasn't sure what was going on, she didn't know. And that's a part of the problem, that you can be the mayor of a city, but you don't know what your police officers, what your law enforcement officers are doing. That's the kind of power that they have, and I think it's really important to be conscious of that.
I'm going to play another clip and come back to part of the conversation. I'll also go to the phones, Donna and William and Deal and Molly. We're going to try to get to all of your calls here at 410-319-8888. This clip also from the march on Saturday is with a conversation with Abdul Salam.
My hand, solidarity, Freddie Gray's family, Tyrone West's family, Anthony Anderson family, and all of the victims of police brutality in Baltimore City and around the nation.
And you had your own nasty run-in with the police, right?
Absolutely. On July 1st, 2013, I was brutally beat by Baltimore City police officers at my home with my three-year-old son, 3 years old at the time, in the van, attacked, violently thrown on my head after being handcuffed, hogtied, then incarcerated.
And what ended up happening with the police?
The police went on to kill a man 17 days later. Two of those three officers went on to kill Tyrone West. After the incident was reported, my incident was reported to Internal Affairs. They responded to the hospital. They didn't do a thorough and significant investigation. Those officers were allowed to walk away and kill Tyrone West on July 18th of 2013.
What do you think it's going to take for the system to change in Baltimore?
It's going to take policy change, statewide policy change, to hold police officers accountable. Baltimore United Coalition is fighting in cohesion to have those changes in policy held accountable in Annapolis. We will continue to fight and for the 2016 General Legislation Assembly to hold the FOP accountable for brutal beatings and fatalities in Baltimore City and beyond.
And that was Abdul Salam. We are now going to go back to the funeral and hear the words of Elijah Cummings, who is up on the podium now.